This is Focus with Emma Griffiths on ABC Radio Brisbane.
You've heard plenty of stories about breast cancer. Well, that's because plenty of women experience it, and a few men. Every day, 50 people are diagnosed with breast cancer in Australia. That's 50 people today. Well, this story is about breast cancer, but the telling of it takes it beyond the familiar awareness campaigns of pink ribbons and fun runs. It's about the big stuff. Love, hope, death, a mother and a daughter, and then a mother and a son. You'll hear this powerful account on Focus today. And what of your breast cancer story? It's special too. Your experience with this disease will be yours alone. So what has happened for you? Maybe it's still unfolding. Perhaps you've just found out and you want to know what breast cancer can be like. And you have questions. Maybe you've just finished treatment and you want to share what you've learned. Maybe it's not you, it's your mum, your partner, sister, daughter. The number for your story is 1300 222 612 to text 0467 922 612. And you can email Focus, focusbrisbane@abc.net.au. Your breast cancer stories as you listen to an extraordinary tale today.
Emma Griffiths, Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane.
What is your breast cancer story? The number again, 1300 222 612. Josie Dietrich's breast cancer story has been published. Her memoir is called In Danger. Josie, hello.
Hi.
You nursed your mother through breast cancer.
Yes, I did.
Then you had your son, who was a high needs child.
Mm.
Then you were diagnosed with breast cancer yourself before his first birthday.
That's right.
When did you feel most in danger?
Well, immediately. So when I was diagnosed, I very much went back to where my mother had been 4 years prior, which was on her deathbed, and I literally watched her die and witnessed her last breath. So I thought, I'm dead. As soon as I was diagnosed, I thought, I've just witnessed my mum die only a few years before. I'm in danger now.
You write, though, that your mother's death saved your life.
Very much so.
Stemming particularly from the very different way that she chose to treat the disease.
Mm.
Can you explain what she did?
Yeah, so mum was diagnosed when she was 45 and she had a science background, but she chose alternative therapies. And so she chose a high dose vitamin C infusions and an alternative German chemotherapy, and I guess, you know, looking at yourself and how you live your life mentally, trying to calm her life down. She was a lecturer, so she moved up to the North Coast near Byron Bay area, and she ate well and all the rest of it. And unfortunately, that didn't work. It was a bit of a death knell, really. Every 2 years, it kept coming back. Eventually, she died of it.
This was right through your 20s, wasn't it?
This was, yeah. So I remember the phone call. I was 21. I was in Melbourne. I was studying psychology at the time. And I flew straight up and I was there with her when she went through her first lot of surgery. It was the beginning of a long reign of surgeries and therapies.
On Focus today, Professor Christabel Saunders is with us as well. Christabel's a professor of surgical oncology, a cancer researcher and a breast cancer specialist. Christabel, what do you make of some of the therapies that Josie's mum chose there?
Well, good morning, Emma, and good morning, Josie. And
hello.
Hello. And the story that Josie has told about her mum, sadly, isn't that uncommon. We know that probably around 5% of our patients decide not to go the conventional medicine route and to try alternative therapies. And that probably is increasing, possibly because of Dr. Google. We're not quite sure why. Mm. And although I think most doctors now do firmly believe in what we would call complementary treatments, things to help you feel better, things to help you fight that fight through breast cancer, to completely reject most conventional medicines, unfortunately, does often lead to the path that Josie described. And in fact, there's even evidence for that. We know that from quite a large study in the United States that people who decide to go the alternative therapy route for their cancer have about 2.5 times more chance of dying, sadly, from their disease. So I guess it shows the power of modern medicine. You know, we are where we are with medicine because of a lot of research over many years and improving treatments. Mm.
Christobel, can you explain the difference when you talk about complementary treatment as opposed to alternative therapies?
Absolutely, and that's a really important thing to understand. So complementary treatments essentially mean treatments which and make you be able to cope with both your disease and the treatments better. And they may be treatments ranging from things to help you mentally, such as yoga, meditation. Many of us, I do those myself. They're great things to help you cope. Mindfulness therapy, right through to perhaps some vitamin supplements, other such treatments, Reiki, massage, things that can make you physically feel better as well. So perhaps not things that are prescribed by doctors, but in fact, increasingly now we're integrating those complementary therapies into our medicine because we know they give people more power over what they're doing and can actually physically and mentally make them better. Alternative therapy, on the other hand, are unproven remedies, often things which, if you look on the internet, are very much spruiked, but with no evidence behind them that they actually improve your outcomes when you're diagnosed with a disease such as cancer. And some of the ones that were just described that your mum took, like high-dose vitamin C and other such things, are common. And unfortunately, not only are they often no good, they can be harmful, and they can also be really expensive.
Yeah, very expensive.
And was it expensive for your mum, Josie?
Very much so.
This is Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane. Josie Dietrich is in studio at the ABC today. Josie's published her memoir called In Danger. It's about her mother's experience with breast cancer, her own experience as well, and so much more. When you were diagnosed and having treatment, Josie, you write that you later came to understand more about what your mother had faced. Were you angry with her?
No, I've been asked that question a lot, whether I was angry. I wasn't angry with her at all. I understood her very well. We were very close. I know that her decisions, it really came to me that her decisions were based on fear. She was terrified of what cancer meant for her body and what cancer meant for her as a woman and what it really means to go through conventional medicine like oncology for how you look as a woman with your breast removal, becoming very ill with your chemotherapy. I think she was just terrified of what I call the real process to have a chance of surviving.
And Christobel, that fear, I mean, that must be a common experience for patients. Is there a failing among, practitioners of traditional medicine to recognise that?
Yeah, I think there probably is. I mean, I think if we try to pick out the reasons that people, if you like, turn their back on conventional medicine, being frightened of the toxicities is a very common reason. I think what's really important to understand, though, is alternative treatments can have pretty awful side effects. And of course, unchecked cancer not only can lead to your death, but it can lead to a really unpleasant death, of course. And we are getting better at managing the side effects of our conventional treatments now. So the awful sickness that comes with chemotherapy, chemotherapy is no walk in the park, as I'm sure anybody who's had it will know. But, you know, we are better at managing those. And so, but I think you're right. I think we as a profession need to learn how to talk to our patients more and help them with that fear. Because if we're frightening people away from modern medicine when that can cure them, then that's a very sad thing.
I agree.
Josie, what have you learned through your experience about what makes a good doctor?
Yeah, lots of things. So empathic understanding of what it's like to sit across a table and be told you have an aggressive form of breast cancer, being given time to speak and ask questions, not having the watch be checked or your shoes be checked and sent out the door, which happened to me a couple times. Seeing you, there's a wonderful a book about what's called empathic witnessing, which is when the doctor is able to see you as a person outside of your disease and really connect with you as a human being as well as your disease.
What's that book called, Empathic Witness? No, it's about
I can get it to you after. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah, because throughout the book, so Josie's book is a memoir. It's called In Danger. And you, I mean, you write in it about what you are reading at the time. You're not reading books to escape the situation. You're really reading books that you say will help you get the language to describe your life, which I just found a beautiful way of describing it. And you have quotes in there from such diverse sources.
Yes, Breyer is the gentleman who wrote about empathic witnessing.
Breyard. So if you're listening to the program today and you've just been diagnosed or you're in the midst of treatment, are there books that you would recommend to read if you wanted to feel like here's a book that helps me explain what I'm going through?
My book.
Yeah, In Danger.
Ruth Pelterson helped me a lot. So she's an American. She was a businesswoman and was diagnosed. And she set up a blog so that women could just write in explaining what they're going through and ask the community questions about how they're coping with breast cancer treatments. And that blog was turned into a book. And I found that incredibly helpful because of the different stories I was able to access, as well as the different answers and just what happens to women's bodies. That was the best source for me, actually, apart from medicos, about what will happen to me.
Mm. You can do pretty much that as well on Focus this morning. You can call in with your story and your question about experiencing breast cancer, and perhaps it's not you, it's your wife, your partner, your mother, sister, daughter. The number is 1300 222 612, because Josie Dietrich certainly has stories to tell about it. And Professor Christabel Saunders is with us as well. And Christabel's a breast cancer specialist, a professor of surgical oncology and a cancer researcher. The number again is 1300 222 612. Josie, what can you tell us about what did happen to your body through this experience?
Well, a lot. So the first thing was getting the cancer out. So that happened very quickly. Within a week of diagnosis, I was under the knife and had just the tumour removed.
Within a week?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed on Friday. On the Monday, I saw the breast surgeon, and by the end of that week, I'd had the lump removed as well as 9 lymph nodes. And then, boom, I was into chemotherapy very soon after. My cancer was pretty aggressive. It was called triple positive, meaning it likes estrogen, progesterone, something called the HER2 protein. So I was into chemotherapy pretty quickly. I didn't go very well. Some women can go okay with chemo. I was not one of them. I was hospitalized with no white blood cells.
They thought you had swine flu at one point.
Yeah, they thought I had swine flu. I had a bacterial infection attacking my organs. I was in an isolation ward. Then I was off. And then it was just really a cycle of just surviving through 3.5 months of pretty grueling chemotherapy. Then I had both my breasts removed. And then within 6 months, I had a radical hysterectomy. So cervix, womb, fallopian tubes, and ovaries removed.
Can you explain why that was thought necessary?
Yeah, that was, well, there's two things. So because I was 35 at the time, and a relatively young woman, my estrogen came back really quickly after, or my periods came back very quickly after I finished chemotherapy. So they put me on a drug that stops, it was like a chemical menopause, so it stops your ovaries from producing the progesterone and estrogen. And that's a once-a-month injection. I would have had to have been on that for about 10 years or when I went into menopause naturally. But the more effective response was to remove, because then, of course, they're not pumping out any estrogen. But I'm also, so that's why my decision, part of to go back a couple steps when we were talking about my mother and her choices. I witnessed her die, but I also really knew her, so I knew her decisions were not going to be mine. And so when I was diagnosed, I chose like a medical belt and braces, you know, so I did absolutely everything that I could to remain cancer-free. So that was my decision. It wasn't the doctor's. It was me just going, remove my breasts, remove every single female organ, part of my brain. And that's why I chose that. And then I'm on a drug every day still that leaches my fat of estrogen called Arimidex.
That's a lot.
It's a lot, yeah. Mm.
Christabel, you said that there are, there's complementary therapies that can make chemotherapy and the treatment for breast cancer a bit easier for patients. Can you advise what they are?
Well, I think what Josie described of really learning about your disease is a really important thing. I mean, knowledge is power, and obviously, Josie, you went out to find out as much as you could.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, nowadays, we generally work in teams for breast cancer, and that'll include not only the surgeon oncologist, but a breast cancer nurse who's a great source of information. And there's also some fantastic support groups in this country. And I think that's one thing, you know, because of women power, the advocacy movement in breast cancer is terrific. And so groups like the Breast Cancer Network Australia or other local groups, which really give women both information and peer support, and you know, being able to share stories, and which is obviously what you're doing this morning on the radio. So those things are powerful, because getting knowledge and understanding things, you can cope with things better, I think, generally.
Absolutely. And I still have a group called Breast Friends for Cure. We meet regularly, we're very close, and we've been a support for each other throughout all of our sort of ongoing years since breast cancer. We met in hospital.
Is this the group as well that you call the right wingers?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, nothing to do with politics, everybody. I'm not right wing. It's to do with our right breasts being removed, and that's why we're right wingers.
Yeah, I love the way you describe that, like the original Amazons.
That's right. So you can take it off so you can do something.
Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane today. We are talking about breast cancer and getting your calls as well, your experiences and questions. 1300 222 612. Alison in Kedron says there are also men who suffer from breast cancer, but no one is talking about them. Hey, Alison, I mentioned them right in the beginning.
You did.
So, and I am careful about that. I take your point, but it's on board with me. And the statistics are that you have, as a woman, a 1 in 8 chance of being diagnosed by the age of 85. And for men, it's 1 in 631.
Yeah.
So it's there, but it's
nowhere near
what the chances are for women. Mm. Leah has called in. Yeah, they have other things as well, blokes?
That's
Leah
right.
is in the city. Leah, what's your experience been with breast cancer?
My mother was diagnosed in 2013 with breast cancer. She's probably like a lot of women, she had actually a visible symptom, and she let it go, you know, just disregarded it. And it was when she was about to go to South America for a holiday, she went to get her vaccinations, and she said, look, while I'm here, can you have a look at this? And, she actually ended up with, I think it was about a 6-centimetre lump, and it was stage 3 cancer, so it's very aggressive. They'd said that had she waited for her next annual check that she wouldn't have made it. And she wanted to go the natural route for treatment. She's quite terrified of needles. And when she, you know, began talking to the family about juices and cleansers and all sorts of things, the family sort of rallied together and told her that, you know, we weren't happy to watch our mother fade away. And so, fortunately, she did choose to go the conventional treatment method, and she's now 4 years cancer-free.
Oh, well done, Liam.
Yeah. So it was very brave of her because her fear of the needles was really quite crippling, and she did have it quite a bad run of it. She ended up in emergency every time she'd have chemo with her white blood cells plummeting. So, yeah, we're all very, very proud of her, though.
Mm. It's great that she listened to you, Leah, that she took on board what you said. But also I think with this, when you've got support around you and a family, then I guess she would have felt that she could do it, you know, because she knew that you were there every step of the way, whether she was scared or not.
Yeah, well, she's always made a big deal about becoming a grandmother one day for a long time. So, of course, we, you know, use the emotional blackmail.
Babies, mate, babies.
Well, and she now has a grandson.
So. Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank
you. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And there's also something fabulous called a porticath, which is what I don't like needles either, actually. I hate them. And so I had that inserted before I had any of my chemotherapy and most of my surgeries. So you get that inserted into your body and it just goes straight through the skin in, so you don't have to have any needles.
Mm. So how...
Brilliant.
So, and that was there sort of at the top of your breast.
Yeah, yeah. It's plugged in straight into your heart. I mean, obviously... I'm not the medico here, she can talk about it, but yeah, so the porticath was inserted directly in.
Mm. Christabel, is that something that's done commonly?
Yes, it is. Many patients having chemotherapy will have, there's different kinds of implantable devices, as was described. They usually go under the skin and go into one of the major vessels and stay in during the, particularly with something like Herceptin treatment that you have to have for a year. So chemotherapy nowadays usually lasts around 5 months, but Herceptin treatments will last a year as an injectable treatment. So that can be very useful. Yeah.
Fabulous.
Mm. Thank you very much, Leah, for calling with that story. The number is 1300 222 612. A few texts coming in as well. If you do text in, leave a first name with us, because at the moment I've got three texts from Anonymous, and that's fair enough too, I guess. This one, my father was given 3 months to live 20 years ago. He chose to take the alternative path. He's still here today, happy, healthy and cancer-free 20 years later. Please don't turn this show into an alternative therapy bashing campaign. I'm not saying it is the answer. I'm not a doctor, but don't ridicule it. Everybody chooses their own path. I will never ridicule anybody, whether they choose conventional or alternative.
It's not ridiculing, so I can imagine people feel that way. We're just giving a response of what we've seen or what I've seen straight up. You know, my mum lived on Northern Rivers. I've been going to the Northern Rivers for 15 years, which is known as an alternative culture. I have no issue with that. I live in it. But I'm explaining what my situation was and what I witnessed with mum over 10 years. And the alternative treatments she tried did not work. The conventional medicine did work for me, and I had a much more aggressive form of cancer than mum. And not really including people's choices at all, but they didn't work for mum, and they didn't work for many others either. Mm.
Did your mum ever was she doubting her course of action through that 10 years that she was doing it?
Look, later on when some of the therapies became maybe a little bit more better in her view as far as conventional medicine, she did end up having palliative chemotherapy, which kept her going for another 6 months. She was given about 6 months to live. I was living in France at the time. I packed up my life and came back, and I cared for her for a year. So it stopped the tumours in her liver, because it had metastasized everywhere by that point. It stopped the tumours in her liver spreading and her, I guess, dying sooner. So she did accept it when she was classed as terminal.
Mm. Christabel, what would you say to that message that we've just received, that this person's father did choose an alternative path and is living happily and cancer-free now?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to comment on an individual case, and you don't even know what his diagnosis was. And many cancers are not, fortunately, death sentences. And of course, not all patients will be cured from conventional treatment. But I think what's really important is to try to pick out the reasons why people don't want to have conventional treatment. And if you look at those, we've talked about being scared, and that's something that hopefully we can deal with now with support and information. But a lot of patients also don't like the loss of control and want some empowerment, want to take control of their own treatments. And I think working with the medical teams, it's important for both of us to work in a partnership. Sometimes people have obviously cultural and ethical or religious beliefs that you need to respect those. But sometimes there are other reasons, such as mental health issues, coercion by family members. There are some very sad cases, unfortunately, of that. And driven by these testimonials, as I say, on Dr. Google and on the internet, can make people see the non-biological model of disease as a reasonable alternative. And I guess what I would say is, you know, we've since the Enlightenment, science has really revolutionized the way that our world works. I mean, you wouldn't get on an aeroplane if they said, oh, well, we haven't got proper technology to fly this plane. But, you know, somebody said that this is a really good new engine and we're going to give it a go. And medicine has evolved because of long history of research and clinical trials where we've, in a very scientific way, taken the treatment that we have at the moment and tested it against what we think are new and better treatments that have been invented in the laboratory. And many thousands of people have taken part in these clinical trials. We then very carefully publish those, discuss those, and then introduce them into practice. So treatments, modern medical treatments, are not just the whim of what the doctor or the profession think. They're things that have been very carefully developed and monitored over time. So we know exactly how they work, and they won't work for everybody, but we know who they will work for. And I think turning our back on science, yes, everybody has a right to do what they want, but it certainly is not going to be a guarantee of you getting better.
Not at all. I was on a clinical trial as well because I knew the efficacy of clinical trials, so I put my hand up for one as well.
How did you know that?
Because of my mother. So, as I said, Mum was a lecturer in history and philosophy of science, but also had a background in science before she became a lecturer. And I guess I learned at her coattails, really, of how to seek out information, how to research. And so I just researched everything. And so I was also part of CanSpeak Queensland, which is a cancer patient advocacy service. So when I was diagnosed, I just went into the research and what was available. And so I asked my oncologist, you know, are there any trials I could get on? And she looked and she said, yes, I'm actually running one. I said, good, put me on it. That trial actually stopped because they found the drug they were trialing wasn't required, but I wasn't getting that drug, so I was just a control. I was randomly assigned into a control. I'm also an advocate for breast trials, Australia, New Zealand, who breast cancer trials. Thank you. I'm coming down next week to find out the latest information. So they do a brilliant job. If you want to know if you've been diagnosed and you want to find out if there's any trials you can get on, go on their website and have a look. What I also wanted was a lot of attention and the best medical treatment available, which is why I put myself on a trial. There was a nurse every week checking on me. All my medication was free, and I was really well looked after being on a trial. So that's another reason I went on it.
Sounds good.
It is really good.
I wonder as well if there are people sort of thinking your mother's decision to go the natural therapy route is even more extraordinary given her background in science.
Yeah.
How do you come to terms with that?
She was a radical thinker. So she questioned authority, patriarchal, medical, educational. So if she didn't take what was given to her, she always researched her own. At the time she was diagnosed, sentinel node biopsies were in the infancy, meaning they couldn't take just a couple lymph nodes that the tumour drained to, if you like. They had to take all of it. If they take all, you get a really high chance of lymphedema, which is a big swelling in the arm. She didn't want that. The radiotherapy they suggested for my mother can burn flesh. She didn't want that. But a lot of that underneath that was, again, her terror of losing her breast and her look. She was a very elegant, beautiful, tall woman. She was single. She didn't want to be single. So all these things came into the mix. She thought she could think her way out of her breast cancer as well, and that was part of her choosing the tack she took, really.
More calls coming in as well at half time on Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane. I'm Emma Griffiths and you're listening to Josie Dietrich, who has written her story about breast cancer, tells the story of her mother's experience as well. It's called In Danger. And Christabel Saunders is with us. She's a professor of surgical oncology and a breast cancer specialist. So your stories and also your questions on Focus today, 1300 222 612 is the number. To text in 0467 922 612. And if you text, give us a name. Audrey in Wood End. Audrey, hello, you've got a story. What happened?
Well, I'll be as quick as I can. The two things I wanted to say, Emma, and one is that in 2011, when I had my cancer, on the 16th of September, I had spinal surgery. And when I was recovering, I got the clinic letter about the breast screening, and I thought, I can't cope with that right now, because I was getting over a major surgery. And I put the letter aside, and then a couple of months later, I found it, and I thought, oh, will I do anything about it? And I thought, oh, no. And then I thought, oh, maybe I should. And so I rang them, and I went and had this mammogram, and they found a lump. So on the 16th of December, exactly 3 months later, I was in hospital having surgery for breast cancer, and that really saved my life. Mm. So I just wanted to say, don't ever ignore those screen test letters.
Great thing to say.
You could be forgiven for ignoring it, getting over one surgery, you know, but it's important not to. The other thing I wanted to say just quickly is when you do a self-examination, as I did for years, don't lie down when you do it. That's what doctors always tell you. You must stand up and you must do it in front of a mirror, because sometimes you can't tell. You know, you can tell when you see, but not when you feel.
Audrey, and how have you been since 2011?
I've had two scares, Emma, two return scares, but fortunately nothing dire, you know. So I just live day to day, and I've got spinal problems which are permanent now. I've got other things to think about, but I try not to dwell on any of it, you know. Breast cancer, unlike I suppose a lot of people, I didn't want to talk about it, you know. I felt that the more I just got on with it and didn't discuss it and chew it over, the better it was for my mindset.
I think your comment about not ignoring letters is really important, because I did that.
Don't.
I did that. That's why my cancer might have been, had already flicked off into my lymph nodes.
Have ignored that.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad I didn't.
Yeah.
Audrey, what kindness you've got as well to share that with people listening while you're battling other issues in your life. Thank you very much for calling.
If it wasn't me, it could have been someone else, so.
There but for the, indeed. 1300 222 612 is the number. So Josie, you got one of those letters, and
yeah. So I've been getting I got myself checked from the age of 27 onwards because of my mother's disease, via ultrasound. Young women's breasts can be lumpy and hard to see otherwise, and so it was the ultrasoundist who found my lump, not me. But I was late getting there, so I was like 4 months behind going for my regular ultrasound, and when I got there, she felt it and said, have you felt this lump? I hadn't. I was only, my son was 9 months old. I was still breast expressing. My breasts were all over the place.
You were exhausted.
I was exhausted. He was also high need, so I was on a different train there. And when I felt it, I knew immediately it was cancer. It was a hard P shape. It was pretty obvious what it was.
Mm. Christabel, 4 months doesn't sound like a long time. Is it a long time in terms of cancer?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily, no. I mean, fortunately, most cancers are not particularly rapidly spreading. Most are slow growing, and most cancers that are picked up through breast screen, through mammograms, are those more slow growing ones. But we know that some groups of people will have faster growing cancers, and that's particularly young women or those who have a very strong family history and perhaps have one of these BRCA genes, you know, like Angelina Jolie had. Mm. And we know that they're often the more aggressive tumours, and the kind that Josie described, the triple positive, can be faster growing. And those, unfortunately, are not the kind that are normally picked up in screens. Of course, we don't regularly screen the population in this country under the age of 50, unless there's a strong family history, such as in Josie's case. But two-yearly mammography for most women over 50 is sufficient.
Mm. And it is free in Queensland too, isn't it, for most women?
It's absolutely free. You get a letter. Anybody on the electoral roll will get a letter every 2 years between the ages of 50 and 74 inviting them to go for a mammogram. And in fact, you can elect to go and have a free one between the ages of 45 and over 70 as well at any age every 2 years. And if you have a family history, it's probably, I think if you do have a family history or you're concerned you have another reason that you're at high risk, the best thing you can do is go to your doctor and have a chat about that, because there are lots of things that need to be put together into that mix, and then perhaps get referred to a breast assessment centre to try and work out what your risk really is. And another tip I have for you, which has just come out actually, is a great website for those who like looking on the web. It's actually under the Peter Mac, which is the cancer hospital in Melbourne, and under the Peter Mac website is something called iPrevent, and it's a great tool for being able to look at putting a lot of information about your family history, about things such as how many children you've had, etc., putting all of those into the program, and it'll give you some kind of estimate of what your risk is and suggest what you should do about it. So anybody who's interested, I suggest they have a look at the iPrevent website.
Fantastic. Mine wasn't free, so I did elected it myself, and it was ultrasound, not mammogram, for me. But that was my decision, and it's what saved my life.
Rosie's called in from The Gap. Rosie, you've got questions.
I do. Good morning, Emma, and I'm sorry I missed the other person's name.
Josie and Christabel.
Hi, Josie and Christabel.
Hello.
I just had a two-part question. Firstly, probably because I'm an old nanner and have a lot of time to listen and read, I'd heard about the protective from reputable sources of breastfeeding in the prevention of some breast cancers. And the second part of my question, at the same time, there's more and more evidence emerging about the role of hormone-disrupting chemicals in our environment and their individual or combined effect on the upsurge of cancers in reproductive organs in animals and also in men and women, like prostate cancer, breast cancer, ovarian. I just wonder if your experts would like to comment on the breastfeeding protective thing and the hormone-disrupting, because there's so much research on genes and their role, which is important, but nothing else, it seems.
Love your well-read nana questions there, Rosie. Christabel, what do you reckon about the protective role of breastfeeding?
Well, I guess what we're talking about is what are the risk factors for developing breast cancer. So what makes a woman higher risk of developing breast cancer or a lower risk of developing breast cancer? And, of course, the first thing is just being a woman. We've already said the very few, 17,000 women each year in Australia will get breast cancer, only about 100 men. And secondly, as we get older, breast cancer, like most cancers, is a disease of ageing. But it can, of course, occur, as in Josie's case, in younger women. And then for some women, there will be this strong family history running through the family. But there are other things that increase our risk as well. So anything that exposes us to more estrogen, so that may be you have your periods for longer, you start them earlier, you go through menopause late, having less children exposes you to those female hormones for longer. Breastfeeding is a good thing, but for an individual, that probably makes little difference. I mean, you don't have lots of children and breastfeed for a long time just in the hope you don't get breast cancer. It would give you a lot of other headaches, I think. there are things we can't choose really about us, and we can't choose when we start our periods or when we go through menopause. But then there are estrogens from the outside, and notably those two, I guess, are the oral contraceptive pill and the HRT. Because breast cancer is rare in young women, the oral contraceptive pill on the whole doesn't make a lot of difference. But if we take HRT for a prolonged period, there's a bit of an increase in breast cancer risk. Only a bit, but it's a small amount. So you have to weigh that against the benefits. And then there was some interesting discussion about, other things in the environment. And I think that's really interesting. And at the moment, it's difficult to detect what those are. I mean, you guys may remember Toowoomba and your ABC radio studios the cluster of breast cancers in young women.
Toowong.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
No, and many of us were working there for 5 years. So I've just had a scan.
Fine. Looked at everything that could have caused those. And probably the only thing that came down to it was that many of those relatively young women who got breast cancer did shift work. And we've done quite a lot of research around the world that shows that shift work does all sorts of things, of altering our hormones, but also altering melatonin levels. It makes us eat in a poorer way. It makes us do less exercise. And all of those things combined may slightly increase the risk of breast cancer. So may have been what contributed to it. So I guess the
things shift worker as well.
Yeah. So the things we can tell you, I think, to avoid getting breast cancer, if, you know, there's no complete way, is staying fit, doing exercise. There's some really strong research now around regular exercise. 150 minutes a week is something to make you sweat. And in fact, exercise has now been shown to be great after a diagnosis of cancer at improving the prognosis.
150 minutes a week of sweating.
A week. Yeah, basically.
So it's not just in a sauna, though.
No, unfortunately. It's not easy. And staying slim, well, staying, you know, with the most normal body weight that you can. And I guess, and alcohol is another issue. Alcohol is a carcinogen. It's something that causes a lot of cancers. And I, for one, I mean, I'm certainly not going to say don't drink anything. I enjoy my odd glass of wine in the evening as well, but, you know, doing it in moderation. So eating and drinking in moderation, doing exercise, keeping your body weight, those are the best things we can do to decrease our risk.
Yes, I had one question as well for Christabel, but then also a response about another really good book about what happens with your breasts. What about phytoestrogens, like in tofu and things like that?
Yeah, well, that's very interesting, and people have tried to look at those, and so far it's very difficult to do research on diets because people don't always know what we put in our mouths, you know. And so there is some worry that some of the things like phytoestrogens contain things that stimulate those estrogen and progesterone receptors in us.
So if you have too much tofu, like soy-based food.
Maybe, but then you look at places where a lot of that is eaten, such as China. Yeah. Breast cancer rates are a lot in Japan. But, of course, those women are also very different from us. They're not overweight. They do lots of exercise. So, you know, it's a very complicated area. Yes. And at the moment, I don't think there is one diet that you could say either causes or protects you against breast cancer, apart from a healthy, well-rounded diet.
Yeah. There's a great book called Breasts, A History in Natural and Unnatural, about a woman who is a journalist, but she's a science journalist, and she researched the effect of certain chemicals on breast chemistry, and it's a really interesting read.
Okay. So Breasts, A History.
Yep.
Good, you'd want to read that anyway, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's really good.
We've got 13 minutes left on Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane. I'm Emma Griffiths. Josie Dietrich is here. She's written her story of encountering breast cancer and her mother's experience with it as well, and the different paths that they chose. And Christabel Saunders is a professor of surgical oncology and a breast cancer specialist. Got a couple more calls coming in as well. Gwen at Woody Point. Gwen, you've had experiences?
Yes, just the odd one or two, yes.
What's happened?
I'm 20 years since I was first diagnosed.
Sorry, that sounds like you're on speakerphone. Are you on speaker?
Sorry, is that right?
That's better.
Okay. So I'm 20 years since I was first diagnosed with my breast cancer, but I have had a secondary. I had uterine cancer and then a secondary vaginal cancer, which was only 5 years ago. But I just wanted to say that, I mean, I just found the topic of conversation this morning extremely interesting, both medically and the non-medical. But as far as I'm concerned, the medical staff that I've dealt with have just been outstanding. Mm. Always knew what was going on. I was always told, you know, they were always happy to explain every step along the way about what was going to happen.
Wonderful. Well, yeah, that's excellent. So you've had nothing but great help and advice.
Yeah, look, I truly love my doctors. They saved my life.
Mm. That's right. And, you know, and I never felt that I couldn't ask any questions.
And
the same for my husband, you know, like if he wanted to know something, he has a science background and he sort of wanted to know different things. And so it was never too much trouble to explain.
Great. That's beautiful. That sounds like the best case scenario, really.
Yeah.
Sean's also called in from The Gap. Sean, what did you want to say?
I just wanted to talk about the risk factors. For me personally, I breastfed 3 babies for a year and I had them all in my 20s. I have no family history of breast cancer. I'm one of the rare people who never took the pill. I also never had HRT. And yet at 69, I found a small lump. Now, I'd been doing regular mammograms every 2 years, no sign of breast cancer. I found a small lump in 2016, although I'd had a mammogram in 2015, all clear. I went and had a diagnostic with the ultrasound and everything, and they found altogether 8 cancers. So I had 2 in the left breast, 3 in the right, and 3 in the lymph system. So they were small. They were all stage 2. But it's interesting to me that, in fact, don't ever think that you cannot get breast cancer because you're not part of all those risk factors, because I had all of these cancers, and they're all estrogen receptive.
How are you now, Sean?
Sorry. Well, I've had the surgery. I had chemo. I had radiation. I've got lymphedema, and I'm on the hormone-blocking tablets. So I'm fine. I'm in what we'd call remission, and I'm very much better than I was last year. I'm much better this year, and hopefully I'll have a long time ahead of me being well without getting secondaries again.
Gosh, we hope. Thank you so much for calling in, Sean. It's lovely to hear from you this morning.
I just think everybody needs to be aware that they can still get cancer even if they've never had any of those things that are identified as risk factors.
I didn't have any risk factors. My mother was the first to get breast cancer, and so when I got it, I was very surprised.
Yeah, because you didn't think that that amounted to a family history. Yeah. Jackie is asking a question. What about radiation exposure from the mammograms every 2 years? Christabel?
Well, that's really good news, actually. The amount of radiation that we get from a mammogram is very minimal, particularly with new technology and the digital mammography. So it's about the equivalent of flying over the Pacific or of eating 4 bananas. It's actually very... Bananas, believe it or not, have radiation in them. Very little.
I have no idea.
Yes, they do. They do. Very
so
little.
Hang on. Getting a mammogram is the same amount as eating 4 bananas.
Yeah.
What, in 1 day? 4 bananas in 1 day?
Yeah.
Yeah. What if I ate 2 bananas in a day? Am I putting myself at risk? Smoothie.
No, you're not. No, you're not. I mean, we're all exposed
obviously
to radiation all
risk.
Around us.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, the background radiation in some places that we live have got a lot of more of it. So places where I come from in WA, the sort of granite hills have got more. But so mammography generally is very safe. There are, however, other forms of radiation that aren't. And there are for very few women who've had something called Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a kind of blood and lymphatic cancer that can attack young people. And then they have to have radiotherapy to their neck and upper chest. And those women are at increased risk of breast cancer. And of course, you know, people who are exposed to lots and lots of radiation as a child. So, for example, who've had to go through cancer treatment as a child. We know childhood cancer survivors, and fortunately there are lots more of those than there used to be, are at increased risk. But the amount of radiation from a mammogram for the average woman every 2 years is pretty insignificant, to be honest, in the grand scheme of things.
Dave in Ipswich has just sent a text in saying, my wife has just been diagnosed with lymphoma, so the experiences shared today have helped me to understand a lot. Thank you, thank you, thank you for the show today. Dave, thank you for your text. All the best to your wife as well with that, you know, with what she's got ahead. So, Josie, there are a couple of things from the book as well that I just absolutely loved. You write about people's reactions to you and the need for an etiquette around breast cancer. A particular day when you were at playgroup with your young son. And what was said to you that made you want to raise your hands in the air and scream at the sky?
Well, I sort of became the go-to person. I was doing a lot of fundraising for the Right to Conquer Cancer, which is for Kiama Berghofer. And so they knew my story, so they would come up and talk to me, which is fine, which I like. But this day I had one woman come up to me and say, oh, I had a friend his wife was diagnosed. It was really aggressive breast cancer. She died really quickly. I was like, oh, okay. And then
this was when you had finished your treatment, or you're in the middle of it?
No, I was in the middle of it. So, and then I walked a couple of steps, and the guy came up to me and said, oh, did you see the show last night? It was called Breast Cancer, My Breasts Can Kill Me. And I was like, oh, no, I didn't see that show. And so it was just like I couldn't get out of the room fast enough. You know, people were just bombarding me with sort of death cancer stories whilst I was clearly ill from cancer treatments. And so I don't know why that was, apart from I think it might be, you know, when you're pregnant and people tell you the horror stories of giving birth and almost dying, I think it's that sort of reaction of you become the focal point in the room. And so they just wanted to sort of talk to me about it, really. Plus, there was also a gentleman in the room whose wife had died, and he was a very young widow with two kids. So it was a really odd response, but that was not an unusual response.
It wasn't unusual.
No.
So there are a few things to not say to somebody who is
going through treatment or diagnosed.
Diagnosed or going through treatment for cancer. What are some of the things that were helpful that were said to you, not by doctors or anything, but by, you know, randoms or friends?
You know, people want to know what to say or how to react, and it comes from a really good place. It's not from a nasty place. You know, people saying, you know, they love you, and is there anything I can do? And the response, I think, when you're going through treatment is, yes, there is something you could do. Could you come and look after my son for a couple hours so I can have a bit of a break? Can you give us a meal? Like, you know, if you're needing practical support, like I did, ask for it. And that's also a way for people to provide or show their love.
Hmm. You write about a particularly difficult time during this. Your partner called it eating cardboard.
Eating cardboard, yeah.
Because you were going through treatment. Mm. Your son, still very young, high needs, still figuring out what exactly his high needs were and were about. Mm-hmm. And then some guardian angels appeared. So this is about the support that can be available.
I think Christabel was talking about it. There's a very strong women's movement around breast cancer, like with the Breast Cancer Network Australia, or just a whole lot of awareness now around breast cancer, especially like with the Angelina Jolie effect and Kylie Minogue and all the rest of it. So Mater Private Hospital has the Chicks in Pink Foundation. One of the breast cancer nurses there I had a relationship with, in the sense of I had my first breast surgery there, and they were just following up with me, and she just phoned that one random day on a Friday and said, how are you going? And I burst into tears and explained that I was not going very well. So I was feeling depressed. I was also coping with a son who was in and out of hospital. I was taking him in and out of hospital because of his high medical needs. And she said, look, there's been a big fundraiser on this last weekend, and two women want to give some money to a woman directly, not straight into like a pool for research. And she said, I'm going to give that money to you. And so what that did is that paid for a carer to come in and help look after my son overnight when he was having hospital stay, so I didn't need to go in, and that, like a nanny. So that provided a huge sort of break for my partner and I, and it helped us, really saved us for that period of time.
Mm, gosh, that was a they're guardian.
Amazing. Yeah, they totally were amazing women.
Guardian angel.
Mm.
Coming up to the end of the show, and there's just a couple of things I want to get to that have come in via text. Margaret has asked, listening to this, that she's heard cancer's become more prevalent as you get older, but that also breast cancer screening is only free until you're 70. Now, the Breast Screen Queensland website says that the program is targeting women 50 to 74 years of age, because that's the age group most at risk, but the program does accept women in their 40s or 75 years and over. So there's your answer to that, Margaret. And we've had another text. It was about another support group, Dragons Abreast Brisbane. You've heard of that, Josie?
Rowers.
Yes. So they paddle dragon boats together each week, and the website is dragonsabreast.com.au. Thanks for making sure we're aware of that. That was from Norbert at Kangaroo Point. Christabel, thank you very much for your time today and sharing your expertise.
Oh, it was a pleasure to meet you both and all of your listeners.
Professor Christabel Saunders, breast cancer specialist and professor of surgical oncology. Josie, about a minute before we say ta-da, where are you at now?
So I'm 9 years post-treatment. I'm cancer-free, have been the whole time. Plan on being cancer-free until I die of natural causes.
Yeah, long time from now.
A long time. My grandmother's 91, so may I follow her steps.
And where is she?
She's in Wales. I'm Welsh.
Mm. And how's your son?
He's good. So my son is 9. He's non-verbal autistic. He goes to mainstream school with an integration aid.
Mm. And you do lots of work now around raising awareness for breast cancer?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I'm a breast cancer advocate.
Mm. And thank you very much for writing your experiences in this lovely book. It's called In Danger, A Memoir of Family and Hope by Josie Dietrich. Thank you for your stories today. Sharing them makes a big difference to people, I'm sure, listening to that. This has been Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane. I'm Emma Griffiths. I'll be back with you tomorrow from 10, taking another hour to look at another big issue.